Well, we're going to spend some time thinking about Psalm 127. So if you turn back in your Bibles to Psalm 127. As human beings, we're a hive of activity. We've had a Christmas break, but we're a few days into the new year. And I expect you're already gearing back up to get back into the swing of things. It's that time when maybe you start thinking, well, what are we going to do for holiday this year? Start planning your holidays, maybe. At work, maybe you've been set new objectives, and it's the time to start getting stuck into them. It's things you want to get done in the house, around the house, things you want to change, rooms you want to paint, whatever it is. I'm sure you've got plans. We all have plans in life, and that's fine. It's good. It's appropriate. But I know this is sort of stating the obvious. We're not the first generation to have lived on this planet who have had plans. People in Solomon's day had plans they made too. It was Solomon who wrote Psalm 127. And in this psalm, he paints a picture of normal, everyday life. So in verse 1, where he talks, he says, unless the Lord builds the house, it's a normal picture he's describing of people who build houses, a common everyday sight in his world. People building houses. Then still in verse 1, he talks about protecting a city. He talks about watchmen. Because every city would have had a watchman. A city would have had walls, and you'd have watchmen posted day and night looking out. Are the enemy about to come over the hill and suddenly attack us? And then verses 3 to 5, he talks about children. Having children. Producing a family, having heirs, which is very important in their culture. It's a picture of a family who, you know, perhaps parents who want to have children. Now, we don't have watchmen here in Nelson. Perhaps very few of us, if any, are involved in building houses. We leave that to the professionals. But nevertheless, I think you can see the point. He's painting a picture of ordinary life. People going about their daily business, making plans and then carrying them out. But Solomon's doing that because he wants us to remember there's one thing we must never forget with our ordinary plans that we make. That's that none of our plans can be achieved without God. None of our families can flourish. None of our communities can be protected from the enemy. Nothing happens without God. That's the theme that joins these verses together. That's the big theme of this psalm. Because firstly, go back to those builders. He says the builders who are trying to construct a house, well, they can't build it unless the Lord builds it. Unless he builds a house, they labour in vain. And then with that city, he says, look, unless the Lord guards that city, the watchman can stay up all night scanning the horizon. He can do his job to the best of his ability, but he'll achieve nothing unless the Lord allows it. Notice that same phrase comes up twice in verse 1. The Lord, they labour in vain. The watchman stays awake in vain. And then it comes up again in verse 2. It is vain for you to rise up early. You get the point he's driving at, don't you, from that repetition. Our work, our efforts are vain, futile, unless the Lord is also at work. And then he talks about children again. Where do children come from? Verse 3, they're a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. It's that same point again. The fruit of the womb, children, it's not something that's manufactured or concocted. They're given by God. Now, we said this psalm is a psalm of Solomon. What was one of Solomon's great achievements? If you know something of the Old Testament and you know a bit about the life of Solomon, you'll know one of the big things Solomon did was he built the temple. Building the temple took a labour force of about 500,000 people. Now, by way of comparison, you've probably seen on the news at various points, all the stadiums being built over in Qatar for the World Cup that's coming up. Now, they're taking about 800,000 labourers. But think how many stadiums there are. Loads of huge World Cup football stadiums being built. So for Solomon to build one temple and it takes 500,000 people, you see it quite clearly. This is a huge operation that Solomon has achieved. It took 11 years to build that temple, Solomon. But that's not even the only thing Solomon built. In 1 Kings chapter 7, you can flick there in your Bible if you like. In 1 Kings 7, I'm not going to pick out particular verses, but in the opening verses there, you have a record of all the other things that Solomon built too. It says he took 13 years to build his own house, his palace. It says he also built the house of the forest of Lebanon. He made the hall of pillars, the hall of judgment. These are all big, significant buildings in their own right. Why am I saying all this? Well, it's because if anyone has ever earned the right to be able to say, I can build houses, I know how to do it, I can achieve this by myself, it's Solomon. This is not the psalm of someone who's been sitting at home moping around saying, I can't do anything, can I? It's hopeless. He's achieved tons. But having done all those things, he still says, you know, unless God builds that house, it just won't happen. And think about Solomon's experience of protecting his nation as the king. And during Solomon's father's reign, David, there'd been loads of wars. David was constantly fighting battles, going away, constantly under attack, both as a nation and as a king personally, attacked by his enemies. But Solomon generally lived in peace, didn't go off and fight battles, wasn't constantly warding off attackers who were coming over the hill. Actually, 1 Kings 4, verse 20, describes his reign in this way. It says, Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand by the sea in multitude, eating and drinking and rejoicing. You see the picture we're being painted there? A life of peace, eating and drinking. It says, so Solomon reigned over all kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines as far as the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. Other nations brought tribute, gifts to Solomon to keep him sweet. So if anyone could ever have claimed, I've brought about peace, I've set up an impenetrable system, the enemies don't even bother trying to come and attack me, I'm in so much control, I don't even need a watchman. If anyone could make those claims, it was Solomon. And then think about that third thing he mentions in this psalm, the fruit of the womb, children, in verse 3. Now, we're not told how many children Solomon had. In the Bible, there are three children recorded, but they're just mentioned in passing, two daughters and one son. But we're never actually given a list of how many children Solomon had. So I'm speculating a little bit here, but let me put it this way. Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines, women he was free to sleep with. So I suspect if he had 1,000 women, he probably had thousands of children. I'm speculating a little bit here, but I suspect Solomon had more experience than anyone else in his generation of producing children. And yet he says children are a gift from God. You see how it's important that it's Solomon who wrote this psalm. This is a message we need to hear again and again. And it's one we need to hear especially in the areas of our lives where we actually have quite a good track record. Because we can all start looking at the things where we've achieved something in the past and start to assume, well, of course I can achieve that again. We can do it just with very easy things. I think I'll go to the shops today. I'll catch a train into Cardiff. I'm going to go and change that light bulb now. Very easy things, as long as the train's running. But we can forget those verses I read to the children, spoke to the children about earlier from James 4. It says, come now, you who say today or tomorrow, we'll go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell and make a profit, whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? It is even a vapour that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. Now, if you're not a Christian, if you're not a follower of Jesus Christ, I think by implication you have to conclude that all your achievements are yours. I think you also have to conclude that all your failures are yours as well. But actually, taking the credit for our own achievements doesn't in the long run lead to a happy life. Because it's not true to reality. God is in control whether we acknowledge him or not. And actually, the longer we live denying that God is there and real and control, actually all we do is we risk getting to that point where his patience runs out. And he puts us in a place called hell where we cannot but deny his ultimate control, because there's nothing enjoyable we can do there at all. Actually, there's a different response we're meant to have here. Just to bow down and acknowledge him as sovereign Lord over all. Because actually, that's something that Solomon is doing in this psalm as well. This is a psalm about worshipping God too. I've said that it's about ordinary things like building houses and having children, but I want you to notice as well the occasion he wrote this psalm for. The introduction tells us that it's a song of ascents. Psalms 120 right the way through to 134, and about 15 or so songs of ascents. What is a song of ascent? Literally means they were singing it as they were ascending, as they were going up the hill to Jerusalem, to Mount Zion, to the top of the mountain to worship. So this was a song that was sung by pilgrims on their way to an annual festival like the Passover or another feast like it. So singing these psalms as they're travelling along the road together is a way of preparing to worship, to bring sacrifices, to celebrate in the goodness of God. So this psalm's teaching goes beyond our day-to-day affairs. Actually, these worshippers, when they sung verse 1, talking about the Lord building his house, they're going to be thinking as well about the temple, the place they're going to. Now for us, in New Testament times, we see that in the church. Now that's the translation, I suppose, of verse 1, in fact, of the whole psalm for us, that these truths Solomon's teaching applies to us at church level. So let's just think about that a little bit more. Firstly, going back to the picture of building a house, we need to remember that churches need to be built, just like houses. What does it mean for a church to be built? How does a church grow? I would say that ultimately the measure of a church growing and maturing is what Paul talks about in Ephesians 1, verse 18. He prays that the eyes of their understanding would be enlightened. He prays they'd know the hope of their calling, the riches they have in Christ, and the greatness of his power that they have access to. He's praying that the church would grow and become more like Jesus Christ, each and every member. So churches don't grow just by having a bigger budget or more visitors to their services or a more vibrant children's work, although those things can be very good and helpful and reasons to give thanks. Churches are made up of members, so churches grow as those members grow in their walk with Jesus Christ. So that's one of my prayers for us as a church. Will you join me in praying that prayer that our church would grow, that we would become more and more like Jesus Christ? So that's the first picture of the church. The church needs to be built. But secondly, churches need to be protected. That's the picture of the watchman. The watchman's job was to protect the city, and churches need that too. Because it can be easy for churches to slip into a mindset of thinking, of course we're okay. Of course we're safe at the moment. And forget how quickly things can suddenly change. We need to pray that this year we'll be protected from the attacks of people who hate Jesus and hate his people, that we'd be protected in the church's unity, that the church would be together in its mission of following Jesus Christ, that we'd be protected from the devastation our own sin can cause. That needs to be one of our prayers as well, that our church will be protected. And thirdly, churches need new life, the fruit of the womb, children. But again, I'm sure you can see I'm not talking about physical children running around our church, although that's a wonderful blessing from God. I'm talking about churches growing by people being added to it, people being saved, conversions. Will you pray this year that we'd be baptizing people, that we'd have cause to open our baptistry and use it in 2019? When you pray for our church, there's three valuable, essential things to pray for. That our church would grow in holiness, that the church would be protected, and the church would see new life. And that's for the last part of this morning. I just want to think now about two dangers that this psalm is telling us we need to avoid. Here's the first perspective we need to avoid. It's the "I do everything, God does nothing" approach. That's what this psalm is warning us against. One writer puts it this way: lots of Christians are practical atheists. Faced with a problem, we instinctively turn to ourselves to fix it. That's the "I do everything, God does nothing" approach. Think about the last challenge you faced in your life, the last problem you had where you thought, this is going to be hard to solve, I'm not quite sure what to do here. The last obstacle you had to overcome. In fact, maybe you're still in the middle of it right now, and you still don't know how you're going to solve this problem you're in right now. We're to keep in the forefront of our minds the sovereignty of God, that he can change people's minds, that he can open doors that seem to be firmly shut, that he can make documents that have been missing reappear, that he can make relationships that seem so broken just come back to life in a moment. We need to remember the sovereignty of God, because it's possible for us to become practical atheists when it comes to facing our problems. What about church? What about church life? How is our church going to be built? We can think, well, it's all down to us, isn't it? We've got to sort things out. We've got to change things. If we put on some good events, that'll help. Some events that people will come to. If we make improvements in this area or that area. Listen again to Jesus' words in John 15. "I am the vine. You are the branches. He who abides in me and I in him bears much fruit. For without me, you can do nothing." That's the approach we take into church life. Jesus says, without me, you can do nothing. But then here's the second danger, the second perspective we need to be aware of too. And it's the "God does everything, I do nothing" approach. It's the opposite danger. Because actually, if you were to skim read through Psalm 127, you could read it and think, well, clearly all our efforts are pointless. What's the point in bothering? Because they're all in vain unless God chooses to bless them. Why not just let God do whatever he chooses to do? But the psalm doesn't allow us to do that, because the builders still need to build the house, and the watchman hasn't been relieved of his duties and made redundant, and the parents wanting to have children still need to actually try and have children. We misunderstand, in fact, there's a danger that we abuse the truth of the sovereignty of God when we sit back and let God sort things out. Because he calls us to work, to strive, to use our gifts, to pursue our own holiness with every fibre of our being, to change bad, sinful habits and replace them with good, God-honouring ones. See, asking God to make us holy, or to bless the church and grow it and protect it, is like that married couple sitting back and just praying for a virgin birth, or a king asking for his city to be protected while relieving the watchmen and the whole army of their duties and putting them on permanent leave. Or like the builder, just dumping a big pile of bricks on the ground and sitting back and hoping that God will work a miracle and the bricks will just magically be assembled into a house. Of course God can do it. Of course he can. But usually the way God works is through his people. So what do we do? How do we avoid both those dangers? Well, we do recognise, yes, God does everything. He is sovereign. But we're called to do, it says in 1 Corinthians 15, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labour is not in vain in the Lord. Notice that same phrase again, not in vain. Your labour is not in vain, so we're to be always abounding in the work of the Lord. Are you ready to be abounding in God's work this year? Because that's what he calls us to be abounding. To know that our work is never in vain, but ultimately God will use it however he chooses for his own glory. Well, just one more verse I want to talk about before we draw things to a close, because we haven't really touched on verse 2 yet. But verse 2 is important. It talks about how it says how it is vain for you to rise up early. Why do we get up early sometimes? Sometimes it's when we can't sleep. You wake up, it's what, 4:30 in the morning. And you've got that same worry racing around your mind. And you know, that's it, I'm not going to get back to sleep now. I might as well just get up and get on with things. Talks said as well in that verse about sitting up late. Some of us were up late because we can't sleep. Because he says, doesn't he, to eat the bread of sorrows. You've got something plaguing your mind and you just can't stop thinking about it and you're lying in bed and your mind is still wired. Sometimes we get up early and we get up late, and I think this is what Solomon's driving at here as well, because we think, if I work just that bit harder, if I get up earlier, if I stay up later, I can solve this problem, I can sort things out, I can achieve my goals. There's a very important reminder for us in verse 2. It says that he gives his beloved sleep. If you're a Christian, you are his beloved child. And that means when we believe that God is involved in our lives, and when we're confident that he is good, because he is good, that's what means we can relax and rest and sleep, casting all our cares on him, knowing that he cares for us. Now don't misunderstand me, sometimes when we can't sleep, we need to go to the doctor. And there's nothing to be ashamed of in that. That doesn't mean we're failures as Christians when we do that. But this verse is saying, remember, if you're a Christian, you are his beloved child. And that means he will give you the sleep you need. You will never be a minute down on the amount of sleep God knows you need. It was Jesus who said to his disciples after a very long, busy, tiring day, come aside and rest for a while. Don't work thinking everything depends on you. Don't run yourself into the ground. He gives his beloved sleep. And he does it for a reason. I don't know if you've thought much about why God designed us this way. Presumably he could have made humans without needing to sleep, but he didn't. He designed us in a way that means we need to spend about a third of our life with our eyes shut, unaware really of what's going on around us. Why did he make us that way? I think it's to drive home again the point of this psalm. Every day as we go to bed, it's a physical reminder you are not indispensable in this world. The world keeps on turning when you go to sleep. The sun will still rise and the sun will still set, and God will still be in control and he will still be good. So he gives his beloved sleep. Well, there's work to be done, isn't there? We have lives to live this year, things we want to achieve, books we want to read, projects we want to complete, friendships we want to maintain. We have all sorts of objectives this year. We are called to remember, houses don't get built by themselves. That's our final challenge, I think, as we close. The final challenge. What are we going to do to grow this year? What habits are we going to change, develop, break, put in place? But ultimately, as we do these things, remember, ultimately we look to God for growth. Unless the Lord builds the house, we labour in vain. Jesus said, without me, you can do nothing. So we do try and build the house. We strive. We put all our effort into it. But we can also sleep and rest, knowing that it is God who will actually do that building. We're going to close this part of the service now by singing. And having sung, we're going to gather around the Lord's table. And if you're someone who trusts the Lord Jesus, you're very welcome to stay and join us for that. So we're going to stand and sing number 411. At the fourth verse of this hymn, it talks about what we've just been saying. It says, "By consecrating might we ask, or vain the toil, unblessed the task, and impotent of fruit will be, love's holiest effort wrought for thee." It's saying the same thing. As we toil, as we strive, we ask for God's consecration, God's blessing on all we seek to do. So we'll stand and sing 411.